Accession number 19783, reel 2.
Could you describe the perimeter of the ghetto, what it was like, and how difficult it was to move in and out of the ghetto?
The ghetto was surrounded by a wall about 8 or 9 feet high, a brick wall, and of course the Jews had to pay for erecting this wall, and there were gates leading into the ghetto, several gates. I don't remember how many exactly, but there were several gates leading into various directions. And each of these gates were manned by SS men. But from time to time, ingenuity has no limits. From time to time, a little hole was dug either under the wall or through the wall, and little children used to slip out and bought some food, bread or potatoes or whatever, and slip in and brought the food, these meager bits of food, into the ghetto.
You were married in the ghetto.
Yes.
Could you tell me about how? Well, tell me about your wedding service.
There was no possibility of having a wedding conducted in a synagogue, because all synagogues were closed. But we learned of a rabbi who lived on the first floor in one of the streets in the ghetto, and we arranged for the wedding to be there. There were about 10 or 20 people present, and after the wedding we wanted to have our photos taken. And the photographer lived a few streets away. And when we came down and walked towards this photographer, suddenly we saw this dark van approaching. And of course, we at that time, we ran for our lives to avoid them.
Could you tell me how easy it was to arrange for accommodation for you and your wife?
In the house where my wife lived, someone agreed to spare one room for us to live, and this was the accommodation. We had one cupboard, yes, and somebody gave us a cupboard.
Could you just briefly tell me the name of your wife and give me her maiden name?
Yes, the name of my wife was Gutta Hoffmann, and she was 18 or 18 and a half, while I was already 28 or 28 and a half when we married.
Cut that.
Reel 2 continue.
You talked briefly about children digging holes underneath the wall and smuggling in food. How did you feed yourself?
The Germans have thought of everything, and they are very meticulous when they are planning something. They knew that the best way of overcoming any resistance is to weaken the people physically and morally. And physically, they decided that while to survive, one the body requires a certain amount of calories. They decided that the Polish people could survive properly on 1,000 calories, but the Jews will be fed only 600 calories or 500 calories. And of course, this was not enough to sustain life. The result was that hundreds of people, particularly vulnerable people, young and old, became ill, and to make it even worse, they had no roof over their head, because first Warsaw had about 350,000 people before in 1939, 350,000 Jews living in Warsaw. Then they brought in tens of thousands of Jews from various villages from the district of Warsaw, and the 350,000 Jews who lived in Warsaw had to go into a district where only 40 or 50,000 people lived. And of course the living conditions were impossible. Every cellar, every corridor was filled with people, and many couldn't find even this, and they slept in the street. The result was that every morning the undertakers had to collect bodies from the streets. Then, when winter came, the epidemic of typhus spread in Warsaw to such an extent that the Germans became aware of it, and they were afraid of it, that it might spread to the part of Warsaw which is not occupied by the Jews. It was phenomenal that in those times the Jewish hospital was transferred from a district which was outside the ghetto into the ghetto, and yet Jewish doctors started to study the effect of starvation on the human beings, and they wrote down their observations, which afterwards were studied by scientists throughout Europe, particularly in Israel. It is impossible to describe to see people on the pavement. At the beginning they were begging for help, but in the end they were already oblivious of what was going on. So this is one part of life that one observed in the ghetto. At the same time, on a different level, there was hustle and bustle of vibrant life in the ghetto itself. People were interested in entertaining or putting up shows.
Can I do that? Sorry, can I cut, Jim? Are you alright?
No. What, he's not well?
I've got a pain in the chest.
No.
Do you want a drink?
Are you all right, Danny?
Okay, running out.
Okay.
Who is he? Oh, 31.
30. Okay. Danny, you were talking about the vibrancy of life within the Warsaw Ghetto. Could you describe how culture and other things flourished, or at least give some sense of how Jewish life was able to flourish under these circumstances?
Well, Jews always like the cultural life, and even the most deprived conditions, they manage always to find half an hour to either to give a performance, whether singing or musical or on the stage. And this was always going on, even in the most adverse conditions. At the same time, the utter poverty looked you in the face, and you couldn't avoid it. I talked before about the epidemic of typhus. Even at that time, when typhus affected in the great majority healthy people rather than weak and sick people, a healthy person could go out in the street, came home in the evening finding a raised temperature, and within a day or two he was dead. While weak people who always were ailing somehow resisted this epidemic. So I expressed myself previously that life in the ghetto went on parallel levels, the utter poverty and the deprivation on the one hand, and vibrant life, commerce on the other hand. But this was life when Jews more or less were left to themselves, they thought, and there was no thought yet of extermination. Nevertheless, at night, small little cars used to arrive at a certain address, and people were picked out, never to be seen again. And this extermination came about only in 1942.
I don't want you to get into that point yet, Danny. You also mentioned when we spoke last that you had all sorts of people coming into the ghetto, including, if I understand correctly, German Jews. Is that correct?
This was a period when the Germans pushed in into the Warsaw Ghetto people from different districts. For instance, the Germans have incorporated into Germany itself a western part of Poland. And of course, each part of Poland had a certain amount of Jewish population. They expelled these people and they brought them to Warsaw. In other words, Warsaw became like a lake to be drained afterwards easily into the extermination camps.
You described how within the ghetto Jews were left to get on with life. Was there any sense of, you describe whether there were people were able to get or earn a livelihood, either working for the Germans or working for their own account?
Well, the Jewish population of Warsaw consisted in the main of artisans. There were businessmen, there were laborers, but in the main they were artisans, and artisans who contributed a great deal to the economic life of Poland. These artisans suddenly were excluded from various parts of Warsaw, and they were concentrated in the ghetto. And the Polish people were deprived of the products of those artisans. So a two-way traffic developed. Raw materials were smuggled in into the ghetto. and ready-made articles were smuggled out of the ghetto, and by these activities people managed to make a living. The Germans were so cruel, and at the same time it was so planned ahead to deprive the Jewish people of any means of sustenance. For instance, if someone was a merchant or a manufacturer and he happened to be a Jew, he was given half an hour time to deliver the keys to the police station or to the German authority, and the German authorities took over either the business or the manufacturer or the factory, whatever they were producing, and he was deprived completely of any means of sustenance. Now, various articles like leatherworks or woodworks or tailors, they were all concentrated in the ghetto, and they needed the products of those artisans. So that's how this developed. The raw materials were smuggled in the ghetto, and the ready-made articles were smuggled out. And it was in this way there was a certain cooperation between the Polish people and the Jews in the ghetto. Telephones were still operating, although there was no traffic in and out. Very few people had permissions to go out of the ghetto.
He talks about Jewish life having an autonomous quality to it in the ghetto. Could you describe to me the Jewish authorities, the Judenrat, and also the Jewish police, and how they functioned?
Well, the Germans wanted to maintain a certain kind of being separate, not to be the direct order-giving authority to the Jewish people. So they nominated a Judenrat, which is an authority consisting of certain personalities among the Jews, although their policy was to eliminate educated people from among the Jews, doctors, lawyers, engineers. They were picked out and disappeared. But certain people they nominated to be representatives of the Jewish people in the ghetto. Now, they were given a task, first of all, to collect taxes from the people who live in the ghetto, and also to give them authority to distribute the meager rations of food among the Jewish people. This caused a great amount of friction. Because of human nature, people accused other people of being partisan and not being just, and so forth. At the same time, they wanted to give the Jewish authorities a certain power, and they asked them to form a Jewish police, which will assist the Judenrat, and by implication also it will assist the German authorities. They were, some of those Jewish policemen were perhaps more enthusiastic than others, but on the whole, they were being looked askance by the other people. They didn't have much authority in any case. They were ignored in the majority of cases. But the Judenrat had a very, very difficult task to perform, because they were told, do this or do that, and they didn't have the means of doing it. Finally, this was going on during 1941 until July 1942. In July 1942, the German authorities announced that to ease up your loss, you can volunteer to go to the East. And there you will be provided with work and food and clothing and so forth. They were not specific to say where to the East, what is the name of the place where you are going, and what sort of work you are going to have to perform. And many thousands of volunteers came forward to be sent to the East. Every day, about 6,000 volunteers were sent off, not to be seen or heard of again. And then, when these volunteers started to become thin on the ground, the Germans made traps in the arranged traps in the street, and whoever was caught in the trap was sent off. And among those were old people, disabled people, blind people, or children, and they were packed to capacity in those cattle trains and sent off. And one or two of those who were sent off came back and said, this is all a lie. They are being sent only a few tens of kilometers away from Warsaw, to a place called Treblinka, and there they are being exterminated completely. Well, the news came to Warsaw, but the human brain could not apprehend, could not understand that such a thing is possible. And they still continued to come forward, but they were aware that something odd is happening. And they started to dig and make various secret hiding places. In other words, they became, during the day, like rats digging into small holes to try to find a shelter. And the Germans started to invade these houses and dragging out people from all sorts of hiding places in order to fulfill their task of sending 6,000 people away. And this was going on for 3 months.
You yourself witnessed the deportation of Korzak, the head of the orphanage, and the children. Can you describe that?
Yes, I was at that time hidden in a cellar on the Jikastra street, a street leading into the Umschlagplatz, which was the concentration place from which the train loads were sent to Treblinka. And it was a hot summer day, and Korczak was leading a group of children, maybe 100 or 200. They were all holding bread with honey running through the bread, because this was given them on the way. And he was leading this group to the Umschlagplatz. I was told that he was approached before entering the Umschlagplatz, that he was approached by a German to say that he could save his life because he was so prominent in science and the educational circles, because he used to lecture in Germany as well, that he could save his life, and but the children will have to go. Of course, he refused the offer. He said, where my children are going, there I must go as well. And of course, he perished in Treblinka.
You mentioned earlier that the Judenrat was in a fairly difficult position. There was one character by the name of Chernyakov, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Could you tell me about
he was given the task of delivering.
Could you start again? Because I think your voice and mine overlapped. If you mentioned Dr. Chernyakov.
Yes. Before the start of the extermination, Chernyakov was given the task of delivering 6,000 people to the Umschlagplatz. And when Chernyakov asked, what is the purpose of this, he was told, this is not your business, and this is what the task you have got to fulfill. And Chernyakov knew what was awaiting the people, and instead of fulfilling the order given by the Germans, he decided to commit suicide, and he committed suicide at that time.
What position did Dr. Chernyakov occupy?
He was the head of the Judenrat.
You mentioned earlier that people had difficulty taking in the idea that was revealed from the people escaped from Treblinka. Could you comment on that a bit further?
Yes, but you see, human nature is such that this is a thing that is incomprehensible. No one can take it in that someone is planning a complete annihilation or murder of a whole people. This is inconceivable. So although on the one hand they heard this from a witness, but on the other hand said, no, this is impossible. But nevertheless, they took precautions and they started to hide. They started to build shelters, hiding places where to hide during the day. Or at night, they came out and tried to either to find crumbs of food or whatever, or to meet members of family.
What was your own reaction to the state of affairs? People disappearing all the time to this unknown destination, obviously
for their deaths. Yes, young people said, well, there is no escape. There is no doubt that the Germans are set to murder all the people. So they decided that, yes, we have got to die. At least we shall die and bring a few Germans down with us. And they started to conspire to form a resistance movement. And the first sign of resistance, we had a few pistols among ourselves, and a few pistols were smuggled in, and ammunition, but nothing of great importance. And the first sign of the resistance being felt was when the chief of the police of the Jewish police was shot, murdered in the ghetto. And then this was the sign that the Germans read as well, and they stopped. I think it was in October, this forceful elimination of Jews, and there was a pause for 3 months. October, November, December, yes, 3 months there was a pause and no actions. It was called an action, the elimination, the catching of people, no action took place. And during that time, young people organized themselves into small units, and they planned resistance.